All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for attending yet another People's Rights meeting here in Pasadena at Victory Park. We're pleased that you're all here. And today we have a couple little items of business for People's Rights. We are going to have a new area assistant, and she is here with us today, and that is Yurnea. And Yurnea is going to be our new area assistant since Ashley is moving to Florida.
Is he?
He is. He left, or he is leaving in 2 days. So we won't have Ash, unfortunately. So, Ash, if you ever see this, we love your brother, and I hope it works out for you well in Florida. But anyway, Yurnea is going to be taking on the role of area assistant, so we've got that coming up. And today, you know, we have a speaker that's going to be talking all about our health, and his name is Joshua Lane, and he's active on the radio show, and the radio show is called Here's to Your Health with Joshua Lane. And he's on both AM and FM. So I'd like to introduce you all to Joshua Lane.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and I thank you for the invitation. I'd like to thank Ed for setting it up and Jane for making a very nice poster, which is really nice, smart, good design. I appreciate it very much. And I've always been involved with wellness since I'm a teenage boy. And so today, wellness is what I talk about. I can talk about politics, but I don't really know that much. It's not my subject. But wellness is my subject. And I think it's interesting that today most of us recognize that nutrition is important, and we all take for granted now that we don't want to be eating processed sugar, we don't want to eat processed flour, and that's kind of a mainstream position now. We all have it, but a lot of our friends and family have it. Is my sound good, or should I pick the microphone? Okay, good. Okay, thanks. So let's, since we now here in California, we're lucky, we're in Los Angeles, which is like, you know, a great area for wellness. The climate is fantastic. We grow a lot of great stuff, and people are into it here. And so you don't feel that you're maybe someplace in the country where people are still laughing at you. And this is by way of perspective, how things change, but they change slowly. And I didn't know that when I was a young man. And I got involved with nutrition in the 1960s, and I would like to tell you that I got involved with nutrition for some lofty ideal, possibly to save the whales. But no, I'm very pragmatic. I, as a teenage boy, had acne, and it embarrassed me no end. And so someone said to me, well, first I went to a dermatologist, because I thought, I'm a teenage boy, I don't know anything, you're the dermatologist. I'll do what you say. That's why I'm here. So that dermatologist gave me tetracycline, which I thought, oh, great, I took tetracycline. And so it ruined my teeth. So my teeth are kind of gray, and everyone else has nice pearly white teeth. And 55 years later, I'm still angry that this MD, who I thought he knew something, after all, I was a teenage boy, and not to give away my power, but I was a teenage boy, I was like 15 and a half, I thought, no, that's why I'm here. And so his ideas didn't help me. And I'm angry about it because no one likes to be abused. You know, no one likes to have unnecessary surgery. No one likes to feel they've been taken. I mean, we've all probably had stories we can tell about family and friends in which the MDs did X and we think, wow, is that good healthcare? Actually, while I'm chatting with this, and I'm kind of, let me just mention this. So let's say we have family and friends and we talking about nutrition. They say, listen, Joshua, don't talk to me, you wacko, you know, and I got a lot of that when I was younger, not so much now. So let's just do by perspective, because people today, everyone talks about, well, your position, there's no science there in that position. There's no science. Okay, so let's say the year was 1960. And let's say all of us in this pavilion, we were all teenagers. We were like 13, 14, and we're hanging around, and my parents are talking to another couple. So the two sets of parents are chatting. And one of the parents says to the other, yeah, so my son Tommy just had his tonsils taken out. And we say to our parents, both sets of parents, well, we think you need your tonsils. They're the first line of defense in the lymphatic system, now called the immune system, and we think you need the tonsils. And the parents would say to us, How dare you? How dare you talk to me? I'm the parents, and you, the doctors are taking tonsils out, and you're telling me, how dare you? What could you possibly know? Okay, so what's the point of that diatribe? Do they take anybody's tonsils out now in 2024? They don't. No, they don't do it anymore. But when I was a teenager, they don't do it. They don't do it. So what's the most popular surgery in the United States today? I'll just tell you the answer. Gallbladder. Yeah. 300,000 gallbladders are taken out every year. Now, let's say a person has gallbladder issues. Okay, they have legitimate gallbladder issues. Absolutely. But the liver, gallbladder, pancreas, called triple heater, it kind of the oriental medicine, what we call or used to call oriental, but finally just Chinese traditional medicine. So yeah, liver, gallbladder, pancreas work together. So the person's gallbladder might indeed be not functioning well. Why? Well, they're drinking alcohol. They're smoking cigarettes. They're drinking coffee. They're eating candy bars. They're eating Burger King. So they're exposed to medication, chemicals, preservatives, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, miticides. Okay, so there's a reason for it. But they take the gallbladder out, 300,000 gallbladders every year. But there's no science there, or it's not good science because do we as consumers benefit from that, or do the MDs benefit? So is my criticism of taking out the gallbladder, am I anti-science? No, I'm not anti-science at all. No, but I think you should leave the gallbladder in, but there's money in taking the gallbladder out. There's no money in switching your diet. You know, it's small potatoes. Food is small potatoes. Vitamins are small potatoes. Exercise is small potatoes. It's all small potatoes. And so therefore, the mainstream guys, the MDs, they kind of run the show. And then the news media, they report what they're kind of told. And so we have friends and family who are just as smart as we are, but they have an orientation that says, listen, I just watched Good Morning America, and they said this, so you just go take a hike. You know, they don't want to talk to me. Okay. Now, let's go back. So now, is this a new issue? No, this is not a new issue. That's what I like about, I have a bachelor's degree in history. And when I was a freshman, I remember I read Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. And Thucydides was the first modern historian in that Thucydides, when he was commenting on battles, didn't ascribe it to the gods. He said, no. They had a better line of supply. They had more soldiers. They knew the terrain. So he talked about, in what we might call modern terms, why did they win and why did they lose? And he was considered the first modern historian. And when I was in high school, I thought I was a good history student until I went to college when I realized, aha, so this is what history is, because I just had no idea. So it's nice to read and learn stuff. And also, let me say this too, just in passing. It doesn't matter what your political orientation is. Because some people are into wellness and nutrition, and they get it, and other people don't get it. Nutrition, as soon as someone said to me, listen, Joshua, do you know why your skin is so bad? Look at all the Coca-Cola you're drinking. And I thought, really? I didn't know. I thought, okay, I didn't know. And he said, oh, no, that Coca-Cola, you got to cut that out and all that. Whatever my mother gave me, I ate. You know, mom gave it to me. It was great. I ate it all. So then I stopped drinking Coca-Cola, and in about a month, my skin was noticeably better. And I thought, aha, food, and I'll have better skin, eat better food. And so that's how I got into nutrition. Didn't want to save the whales, nothing lofty at all, very practical. I thought, I want to have good skin. Really, and as teenagers, we can all remember being teenagers. You know, it's an issue now when our body's not cooperating. We all feel a little bad. We have X, and we think, oh, we feel bad. We don't look as good. We all have that. Okay, right. But when you're a teenager, you're especially vulnerable because you think, oh, my goodness, you know. Okay, so food as a healing tool has always made perfect sense to me. And because it always has, I see myself in a leadership position. And because of that, I'm a pretty good school teacher. I don't hit someone over the head with the subject. You teach them, you bring them along. I can teach people about nutrition, but I can't do it in 20 minutes. But over a period of time, I can really make you understand nutrition. And here's why I say I'm in a leadership position here. Because when I listen to music, and I love music, I love the Doors and the Stones and the Beatles, and I love music, right? But I'm not a musician. So when I hear a song, I don't understand any of the nuance of the song. Nope, I'm not a musician, I don't get it. Lyrics, I get, and I like a song, I like it. but I'm not a musician. That's not my skill. My skill is food as a healing tool. It always made complete sense to me. That's why when we, here in the audience, when we talk to family and friends and they look at you like you're from Mars, you have to realize, no, you're just lucky. This is your gift. You get the food thing. You know, if I eat Burger King, if I eat Haagen-Dazs, if I drink vodka, I don't feel good. But other people, just as smart as us, they don't see it. We see it. That's just our gift. That's why sometimes you go to family gatherings and you talk to someone, you give them good advice, you show them books, and they think you're from Mars. You have to understand this is just your gift. I really think that's an important... Okay, now, so let's go back to the 19th century. There was a man whose name you all know. Well, I mentioned the name is Graham. We all know Graham crackers, right? We all know Graham crackers. Okay. So was there a man who made Graham crackers? Well, as it turns out, there was. His name was Sylvester Graham. Sylvester Graham was a Presbyterian minister, health lecturer, temperance reformer, abolitionist, and women's rights advocate, and wellness advocate. So he, you know, all these things we think, well, women's rights, what do you mean women's rights? Well, of course, in 19th century America, women, of course, couldn't vote, and women couldn't own property, you know, so women, you know, that. So women couldn't do much of anything. They just, so he thought that was wrong. He was opposed to slavery. A lot of people in this country thought slavery was good. He thought it was bad. This was 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. He also advocated what he called eating unbolted, 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 archaic term, no one uses it. It means whole grains. And now he was a Presbyterian minister. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and his grandfather was a Presbyterian minister. So he was a Presbyterian minister. But he got involved with the temperance movement. And one of the churches he was preaching at kicked him out because they didn't want him talking about temperance. So he went to another church, and they liked the temperance thing. And then he joined the Pennsylvania Temperance Society. And Philadelphia, at this point, you know, 1810, 1820, 1830, 1840, Philadelphia was happening. Philadelphia was an important city in America. It was the city. Philadelphia was a big city, not New York, not Boston. Those were all the two other major cities. But no, it was Philly. So he joins the Pennsylvania Temperance Society, and he's a Presbyterian minister. And he talks about... And the ministers at that in those days were talking about problems with alcoholism in the United States. It was a major topic, but Graham was the first person to say, well, is alcohol bad for you spiritually, which is what the preacher was saying. Yes, maybe he thought so. But he said, no, it's physiologically bad for you. Now, today we think, well, that's so what? Everyone knows alcohol is carcinogenic. Yeah, but this is 2024. We're talking, you know, 1820 here, you know. So you have to give people credit for ideas. So Graham... He was fantastic, Graham. He was really influential. So he recommended eating whole grain foods. Now, what did Americans eat in, say, 1790, 1810, 1820, 1830? What did they eat? Well, there was no refrigeration, right? There was no refrigeration. No refrigeration. So people ate a lot of salted pork. They ate a lot of salted pork, and they ate fried food, and they drank a lot of alcohol. They drank a lot of alcohol, and they drank alcohol... Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Children, yeah, and why? Okay, so America was is a fertile country, right? So what was happening in 1800, 1810, 1820, 1830? So we settled Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. We had all this fertile land. And so the farmers went there and they grew crops because everything grew because the land was rich. But they couldn't get the grain to market because... They had to put it on barges and float it, Mississippi and the Erie Canal. They already built the Erie Canal. They couldn't get it to market. But they could take the grain and they could process it into alcohol and put it in wooden kegs and float it on barges to the cities in the East Coast, the major cities, Philly, Boston, okay, New York. And so alcohol became currency because we had the technology to move the grain, now in the form of alcohol, into the cities. And so everybody drank. Everybody drank. Women drank, men drank, People smoked pipes in those days. They smoked pipes, they smoked cigars. Women smoked pipes, women smoked cigars. Women drank, men drank more. Women drank cordials, women drank brandy. Men drank that. Men also drank rum. But people drank lots and lots of alcohol, and the church leaders and others recognized this is a problem. This is a problem. But Graham was the first to recognize that it was a health problem. And Graham, he was great. He was great. So he recommended eating high-fiber whole grains. And here's the interesting thing that a lot of us, maybe everyone here knows, but your family and friends don't know this. You know, people have been eating white bread in Europe and in America since the 1820s. No, it didn't start, say from World War I to World War II. No, 1820s, because the milk, people moving to the cities looking for work, starting the Industrial Revolution, kind of getting rolling, you know. By the 1830s, 40s was really rolling. So people moved into factories, they needed their little sandwiches, and they started eating bread, white bread, because it didn't spoil as fast. So they milled all the grain, all the bran, all the fiber out of it. And Graham recognized that. Now, again, he was the first. So Sylvester Graham was very influential. And he lectured, and his lectures were not popular because he opposed the guys who were kind of running things, you know, the bakers and stuff, and processed food, you know, and he was opposed to alcohol. But there was a movement away from alcohol, and that movement in America was strong in the 19th century, continued in the 20th century, and then, they passed the Volstead Act, 1919, where they banned liquor in the United States. Now, the wellness crowd was into banning liquor, and a lot of people who were seen as conservatives were into banning liquor. And, of course, a lot of people were annoyed about it, didn't like it. And, of course, they repealed it, I think, in 1933. When Roosevelt came in, within like a month or so, they repealed it. Because really, it turned out to be a maybe because I'm opposed to drinking alcohol, not spiritually. I don't know spiritual stuff. But physically, alcohol, we know, is carcinogenic. Not just head, neck, mouth, and throat cancers. No, prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, stomach cancer. It causes cancer. So your friends might say, oh, drink a glass of brandy or drink this. It's gourmet. Yeah, fine, it's gourmet. But I'm not drinking it. If you want to drink it, that's your choice. You want to drink it, you drink it. I don't want to. Why? Because I want to be strong. I want to be healthy, and I don't want to drink alcohol. I'm not making a spiritual judgment. No, it's a physical judgment. And really, the science is, no one says that alcohol is good for you now. They tried to 15, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. They said, oh, yeah, wine is good for you. It has resveratrol. Yeah, okay. You can get all the resveratrol you need eating red grapes, which are not the same as wine. Here's what. We have apples. We have apple cider vinegar. And then we have applejack. Not the same properties. So alcohol might be fun. I'm not saying it's not a social bridge. I wouldn't say that. No. People drink, they dance, that's great, no problem. However, alcohol is carcinogenic, alcohol is cancer-causing, no one can dispute that, okay? So 15 to 20 or 30 years ago, if we said that, people said, oh, go take a hike. Now they don't, now they kind of agree with us. Why? Why are there so many more of us? Because the ideas simply can't be suppressed anymore. So that's why this subject has become mainstream. And also, let me just say this, by talk about politics. This subject is not conservative or liberal or Some people just get it. Some people just get it, the food thing. Others, who are just as sharp as we are, they don't get it. But they can build a bridge, or they can write a play, or they can write music. You know, they can do all sorts of fabulous stuff that I can't do. But the food thing just made sense to me. Okay? So we had Sylvester Graham, who was very influential. Now, Sylvester Graham, as it turns out, okay, let me go back just a little bit further. So we all probably know of Benjamin Rush. Dr. Benjamin Rush signed the Declaration of Independence, and he was America's most influential MD from the time of, and he supported the Revolution, from the Revolution until maybe even until 1890. He died. I think in the 1830s he passed away. He didn't last very long. He was only he was in his 60s, I think, when he passed away. He could have been 70. He was America's greatest MD. And what did the MDs at that time, what did the science of the time do when someone was sick? So George Washington was our first president. And George Washington, after he married Martha Washington, was the wealthiest man in America because Martha was enormously wealthy. So the president of the United States, former president, George Washington, is dying. And three physicians, and they were called regulars. That is, you know, they were MDs. And of course, in those days, to be an MD, you may have had a high school diploma. I guess those three men did, and then it was like usually a 3-month course. But you were an MD. So what did they do for the president, the founding president of the United States? They took his blood. Bloodletting. We all know that they purged. They took his blood. They took his blood. Now remember, at this point, they didn't know how much blood we had in the body. They didn't know. But they thought, no, here's how we'll heal him. Maybe he had pneumonia. No one's quite sure, but probably he had pneumonia. And so if we had antibiotics, they could have saved his life. But no, they took blood out from him, and also they did blistering. They would blister. They thought that would pull the bad humors out of the body. So anyway, so eventually they took out so much blood from Washington, he said no, he didn't. And by the way, Martha didn't want him to take the blood, didn't want it. And so the president died. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who was good friends with Benjamin Rush and with Washington, he didn't want Washington to get the bloodletting, but Washington thought, no, this is medicine, this is the science, this is going to take the blood out, and so he died. So would any one of us submit to having blood taken out when we were sick now? Would anyone do? No one, none of us would. No one does it. No MDs do that. But that's what the MDs did in 1780, 1790, 1810, 1820, 1830, 1840, 1850. That was healthcare. That was scientific healthcare. So if you didn't want that, if you were an eclectic physician, although the eclectics actually, well, they showed about 1840, the Thomsonians, anyone know about the Thomsonians? The Thomsonians, they were a movement in the 1810s, 1820s, 1830s, and they used herbs to heal. And they had a program they called simpling, and that is they would use one herb to heal. Because their attitude was, you know, this is not medieval witchcraft. We don't need to put 100 things in a bottle and have you drink it. No. One item. For example, let's talk about garlic. God, we all use garlic. Garlic, we all like garlic. Everyone knows garlic good for us. So who used garlic before us? What historical reference do we have? Well, the ancient Romans used garlic because it was good for the soldiers and good for the populace, and everyone ate garlic. So they ate garlic. The Romans ate garlic, and before them, the ancient Egyptians ate garlic, and supposedly the ancient Egyptians gave all the slaves that built the pyramids garlic to keep them healthy. So, and maybe even the Babylonians before that used garlic, so everyone used garlic, and we all think, yeah, garlic, yeah, we like garlic, you know, we don't make fun of garlic, but if I told you garlic was good for a cold or flu 30 or 40 years ago, you might have said, listen, I know you mean well, but just shut up, you know, garlic, how dare you talk about garlic, now we all use garlic. People say, yeah, but I can't eat garlic because if I smell like garlic next day at business, that's not good. Okay, I get it. Fine. So you can eat onions. Onions and garlic are pretty much exactly the same for healing the body. But onions and garlic heal. Now, how do you prepare the onions? Well, or garlic. You chop them up and you put them in salad and eat them. That's it. Eat garlic. And let's say you have a real bad cold. Like, man, I'm sick. My chest is bad. I'm sick. Okay, I'd recommend eating garlic. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Eat garlic. You know, eat onions. And here's this. Now here's controversy. Let's talk about controversy. So most of us here in this pavilion recognize that when we drink milk, we like milk, but it congests us. It congests us. So does the milk congest us because we're allergic to milk? Could be. You could be sensitive to milk. Or it could be that the milk you're consuming is pasteurized and homogenized. And then your family says, oh boy, you're out on a limb with that one. Oh my goodness. Go take a hike. Okay. So why do they pasteurize milk? Do they pasteurize milk to kill tuberculosis bacilli? No. They don't heat it high enough to kill tuberculosis bacilli. They pasteurize milk, it gives it shelf life. So for us, when we consume this pasteurized, homogenized milk, it doesn't taste like much, and it's congesting, and for most of us, we do poorly on it. And if you're a little run down, you might get congested because you've been consuming too much milk, or someone coughed and sneezed on you. But now, recently, there used to be Altadena Dairy in California. It was raw. They were great. And now there's one called Raw Farm. You probably see that. You can get it at Sprouts, at Lassen's, I think at Mother's, you know, Jimbo's, a lot of places. Okay, so raw milk comes from a certified source. It's one farmer. So when you buy raw milk, we know the farmer. We know the farmer of the milk you're drinking. Now, here's the problem with that. That farmer makes more money because he's selling the milk to the store who sells it to me, and I know it's from his farm. So we know exactly single source. But when pasteurized milk, It can be hundreds of farms put together, and those farmers get screwed. They don't make any money. A lot of farmers go out of business because the distributor, the middleman, makes the money, and then he sells it to the stores. So they don't want it. It's just business. It's just business. So if someone tells you, oh, no, raw milk, you mean well, Joshua, but you're just like, you know, you're out to lunch. No. And raw milk, it's funny. When I was a teenage boy, shows you how little I know about politics. When I was in the 60s and early 70s, I thought, 10 years from now, raw milk will be legal everywhere. That was my take on, you know. So I was completely wrong, completely wrong. Now, 50 years later, actually 60 years later, they're still fighting about raw milk. And then the guy, Raw Farm, maybe was it 2 months ago, they nailed him. They said, oh, my people are getting sick. They're getting salmonella from your milk. And so he said, okay. He knew he didn't want to fight them, so FDA. So he voluntarily recalled the milk. He had every sample tested. Not one of his samples was bad. They had different samples. It wasn't his milk at all. They refused to apologize. And, of course, it was embarrassing to him, and I'm sure it cost him a lot of money. So then he's back on. And then you started seeing in the newspaper, Yahoo News, all this stuff, a little attacks, remember maybe 2-3 months ago, attacks on raw milk. And then they found another person. They said, oh, he was guilty of that. No. But it's amazing how they've never given up. They've never given up on the raw milk thing. Anyway, so that's just, it's just ongoing. But there are many more of us now. And so, frankly, now, it's not exactly that we are, it's not that we have 90% of people listening to us. But I'm guessing we have maybe 40, 50% of people kind of see it the way we do. Now, we here might all be in a leadership position, so we might know more than the average person, but the average person is paying attention in ways that they never did before. Things have changed for the better. People are much more alert. So we had Benjamin Rush, we had Sylvester Graham. Sylvester Graham also recommended things like water cures, and homeopathy. These things were laughed at, except now, let's say, for example, tomorrow we decide to take a trip, all of us, and we're going to fly to Europe, and we go to Paris. And we go to Paris, and one of us gets a little bit of congestion, and someone recommends there's a homeopathic pharmacy there. Why don't you go to that homeopathic pharmacy? Well, in France, homeopathy is mainstream. In Germany, homeopathy is mainstream. In India, homeopathy is mainstream. In America, people kind of make fun of homeopathy as like, oh, my God, you're such a sucker. Homeopathy works. It works. Samuel Hahnemann, why did he, a medical doctor, start homeopathy? Well, the MDs, the heroic MDs, when people were very sick, they used to give them mercury, literally mercury. They gave them mercury. Okay, right. Now, so here's how Hahnemann became very popular. The Duke of Wellington, who defeated Napoleon, had a lot of problem with ringing in his ears, possibly from the sound of cannons being fired. He was a military man, possibly loud noise. Don't really know. Okay, but he had ringing in the ears, and it really, he hated it. He didn't like it. It bothered him. So his MDs, you know, after all, he was Wellington, so he was very high in society. What did the MDs do for him? Now, you're going to all kind of not believe this. His cure was they literally poured mercury in his ears. And, of course, he became very sick. Now, we know mercury is, we know the FDA, World Health Organization says the body, we humans, have zero tolerance for mercury. Zero tolerance for mercury. So this was so widely reported about Wellington that Samuel Hahnemann, his ideas on homeopathy became not prevalent, but popular and widely used. And you go, the British royal family uses homeopathy. So homeopathy in Europe, everyone uses it. In America, people look at you like, you mean well, but you're such a silly person. You know, at best, they think, oh, I always think you're just an idiot. But no. So homeopathy was once fringe. And in most of the world, it's just mainstream. And the ideas of nutrition that we laughed at maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, no, they're just mainstream now. They're mainstream because they worked, not because they're fashionable. If something's fashionable, for example, when I was a teenage boy, bell bottoms were popular. So for 1 or 2 or 3 years, people wore bell bottoms. No one wears bell bottoms now because that was fashion. But the ideas of nutrition that people, mainstream people, maybe laughed at, no, those ideas had merit. And what's the main foundation idea? It's always the same one you always know. And it's boring, too. Don't eat any processed sugar. Not exciting. Not revolutionary, you know. Everybody here knows that. Don't eat any processed sugar. No sugar, no sugar, no sugar. That's it. If you do that, everything kind of goes much better. I hate to say that. It's really very simple. But the problem with nutrition, as I said before, and I'll repeat it again, not a moneymaker. Not a moneymaker. Okay. So we had Sylvester Graham, who gave us Graham crackers, which really were bread. It was whole grain bread. He recommended eating the fiber, the bran. Now, again, he didn't know the science. They didn't know the science, but he knew, maybe empirically, that it was better to eat these high-fiber foods. And so he did. And then the Thomsonian physicians, the Thomsonian movement in the 1820s, 1830s, popular in New England and around the rest of the country, they used herbs to heal. They didn't want to use the heroic measures of bleeding and purging that the mainstream MDs used. That was mainstream science. And if you opposed it, if this was 150 years ago, 200 years ago, and we opposed all that, people said, well, they're just wackos. They're all just wackos. They dismissed us. We had a small crowd who listened to us, but no, people dismissed us. Now more people listen to us. Okay, so let me just also mention, by way of history, and how everything kind of runs together. Remember how I mentioned how Graham, he was involved with women's rights and abolition and nutrition? Okay, and the temperance movement. Okay, so Sylvester Graham was so influential that Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of America's premier intellectuals of the 19th century, wrote a poem about Sylvester Graham and called him the poet of bran bread and pumpkins. Now, that's really very lovely. You know, every one of us knows Henry David Thoreau, we know Bronson Alcott, we know Charles Lane, we know Emerson. Okay, so they were all involved with nutrition because they just thought it made sense to them. It just made sense to them. So my point is, all the movements kind of run together. You know, all the, quote, reform movements kind of run together. And if you go back historically, they did. So, okay, let me mention another person from the 19th century. So it's interesting that in the 19th century, two American women, now remember, women couldn't vote and couldn't own property, okay? Okay, so women were like, you know, they were pushed around. So two American women actually became internationally prominent in the 19th century. And I'll just mention names. You already know their names. Ellen G. White, who started the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And Mary Baker Eddy, who started the Christian Science movement. Now, those women started religions that became international in the 19th century. And the other religion that we in America started in the 19th century was Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. They started in New York, and then they migrated west. So these were important movements. These were very important movements, cultural movements. They had enormous significance. And it just so happens that Mary Baker Eddy and Ellen G. White promoted the idea of wellness. And also Ellen G. White, who started the Seventh-day Adventist movement, she said women could be in positions of authority in her church, whereas women and the rest of the women couldn't do anything. And Ellen G. White said people with darker skin could also be in the church. So people who were escaped slaves or dark in color, didn't have a very good time, did they, in the 19th century or most of the 20th century? They could be involved with Seventh-day Adventists. So they joined the movement. So that is an international movement. Now, some people criticize the Seventh-day Adventists because they hate them because they're not other movements. And they say, oh, that's just a self-help group. No. Oh, it's a legitimate Christian religious organization that's worldwide. And she, Ellen G. White, promoted vegetarianism and hydrotherapy and herbalism and bathing. Bathing, by the way, is something every one of us knows this. Okay, so Sylvester Graham was very radical. He suggested that we should bathe once a week. We should bathe once a week. Because in those days, 1810, 1820, 1830, 1840, people didn't bathe ever. You might say, oh, that's just, no. That's true. Yeah, people didn't bathe. People didn't bathe. But remember, there was no indoor plumbing. You know, no one had indoor plumbing. No. We didn't really have indoor plumbing in the United States until about 1865. We had indoor plumbing. That's not a joke. That's about 1865. Before, we didn't have indoor plumbing. Although there were some houses in the Northeast that had indoor plumbing in the 1850s, but really it's like 1860s. So you didn't have indoor plumbing. So people, if you wanted to bathe, you had to bring the water from outside, and it was cold water. You had to heat the water, and you had to pour it in a tub. And people used to sit in a tub, and they would take a bath, and then the whole family would take a bath in the same water. They didn't know. And so they had problems, didn't they, with cholera, contaminated water. They didn't know. And as a matter of fact, when Lincoln was president during the Civil War, his son Ted died of cholera. And why did maybe the boy, son of the president, die? Well, because he had tens of thousands of troops stationed in Washington, and the men, soldiers, and they urinated right in the rivers. And people didn't know that that was a bad idea. You know, mainstream science didn't know that. Now every one of us knows, no, you can't do that. That's a bad idea. They used to put outhouses in gardens. They put outhouses near wells. They didn't know that was a problem. No one knew that was a problem. Now every one of us knows it's a problem. Everyone, and no one was like, my God, you can't do that. That's make you sick. Okay. So mainstream medicine didn't know diddly. But they ran everything. They had control. They ran everything. So okay, let me see. So just little bits about all those women, and they were important. Sylvester Graham. Sylvester Graham is my favorite guy. Sylvester Graham, he really should be on a stamp. I really, I'm a big fan of Graham. It's amazing. And by the way, he didn't live very long. And also, let me say this too. In the 1830s and 1820s and 1840s, the idea of the lecturer going out to a hall and hearing a lecturer, see, that was it. That was popular entertainment. No, this is not, I'm not making a joke here. I'm also not belittling it. It was like, you got to leave the house, and you went in this big place, and a person spoke to you about ideas. Remember, 1810, 1820, 1830s, we started to have what in this country? Newspapers. We suddenly had newspapers. Before that, we didn't have newspapers. Benjamin Franklin was the first person, I think, to bring a printing press over, But no one really had much, there was not much printing going on. But by 1810, 20s, 30s, you had newspapers, and so newspapers had big influence. Suddenly people could read the paper. Not that everyone could read in those days. Okay. So technology changes things. Everything is changing. And we, the people who believe in nutrition as important and a clean environment, clean water, have always been in the minority. Now we're in as just a smaller minority. Okay, so then let's talk about, this is kind of fun. So what did Americans eat for breakfast? Well, they ate salted pork, because again, they didn't have refrigeration, and they drank lots of alcohol, and they drank boiled coffee, and they ate some fried potatoes. That's what they had for breakfast. So what was the revolution in food, say about 1890, 1900, 1910? It was the first prepared mass-market food, Kellogg's of Battle Creek. Kellogg's of Battle Creek. John Harvey Kellogg was a Seventh-day Adventist, MD. He went to school in New York, and Ellen G. White paid for him to go. Ellen G. White was great with education. Ellen G. White, who started the Seventh-day Adventist movement, she only had a third-grade education, and she was embarrassed by that, she was a poor girl. Her father was a hatter. Her father made hats. And as a matter of fact, as you may notice about Ellen G. White, she claimed that she would have visions. And some people have criticized her, said, no, she didn't. People who don't like the Seventh-day Adventists said, no, she didn't have visions. What she did was, when she was a girl, she helped her father make hats. And as you all know this story, in those days when they made hats, they used mercury to shape the hats. And we all know mercury is poisonous, but in 1820, 1830, 1840, 1850, 1860, they didn't know. And so if you're making hats, you are getting it on your fingertips and you're inhaling it. Now, we all know Alice in Wonderland. And what is one of the figures in Alice in Wonderland? The Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, because when that was written, Alice in Wonderland, in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, many men in the hat industry couldn't complete their careers as hatters. They became mad as hatters because, potentially, they were exposed to so much mercury poisoning. An early example of industrial poisoning. Now, of course, that doesn't happen. Now, they don't use mercury that way. They're like, nah, mercury's a problem. You know, but they didn't know it then. No one knew it. So that's the historical reference to mad as hatters. And Ellen G. White, when she was a 12-year-old girl, she would have visions, and some people said, no, she just, these are problems from mercury exposure, and her hands would shake. So she never had good health. And she, the Orthodox MDs, she wasn't happy with their ideas. So she did fasting, and she did water cures, all the therapies of the 19th century that seemed to help her. And Ellen G. White was a person of enormous consequence. She really helped change things. And so John Harvey Kellogg, who ran Kellogg's of Battle Creek, it was a sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. And they came out with, and he had a younger brother, Will, and Will came out with the breakfast cereals. And so Kellogg's of Battle Creek was the first mass market prepared food, and that was an amazing breakthrough because suddenly people could have, before that people might have had a hot cereal, but now they could have a cold cereal. It was the first American convenience food. And one of the guests who was at Kellogg's of Battle Creek, because he was very sick, he had what in the 19th century was called dyspepsia. Does anyone know what dyspepsia is? It's a lovely, I like the word dyspepsia. I really like it. It means he had problems with digestion. It's an archaic term, but I just love it. Dyspepsia. So Post had dyspepsia. So he went to the sanitarium, Kellogg's sanitarium, and he realized they were into a good thing. So he came out with Post breakfast cereals, and they were bitter rivals for many years. But that's the story of Post and Kellogg. And let me say this too. So we're here in California, and we know in Silicon Valley that Silicon Valley is world famous. Everyone knows Silicon Valley. It's an important center of technology. Well, Battle Creek, Michigan, in the 19th century, was such an important center of technology that every railroad in the United States went through Battle Creek, Michigan, because they had breakfast cereals. Now, Kellogg and Post were the biggies, but there were smaller ones, too. You know, there was Ralston. There were many others, you know. Ralston was a biggie, but they were smaller than the other guys. And so, like, it was the center of technology. It was very important. Okay, just a thought there. Let me see. Is that it? That kind of brings us up, I guess, to date. I don't know, maybe that's really enough. But I wanted to just give you a background onto wellness and what we're part of. We're part of a movement, and I'm proud of that. We're all part of that movement of wellness. And some people focus on a cleaner environment. That's their focus. Others focus on exercise. Some focus on nutrition. People like Jack LaLanne. Jack LaLanne, we all know who Jack LaLanne was. Jack LaLanne, I believe, had the longest-running television show in American history. And Jack would be on, and he brought his wife on with him, and he had a little dog. He knew how to market, and he was involved with exercise and nutrition. Exercise and nutrition. And Jack LaLanne was very influential. And also, does anyone know Paul Bragg and Patricia Bragg? Does everyone know the Braggs? Braggs, okay. So let me say this. I have some buddies, you know, men who are my age, and they make fun of the Braggs. And let me tell you why. Let me offer you some gossip, which I think is just important gossip. So Paul Bragg was an influential guy. And Patricia Bragg, you may have heard that Patricia Bragg was his daughter. How many people have heard that Patricia Bragg was Paul Bragg's daughter? No, she was not his daughter. No. Paul Bragg had a son. Patricia Bragg was married to the son. And the marriage didn't last very long. And they broke up. They divorced. But Paul Bragg recognized Patricia Bragg was a wellness person. She was into exercise. And we're talking in the 1940s now, you know, when you know, women didn't exercise, people didn't exercise. She was into exercise. She was into nutrition. So Paul worked her into the act. I'm not being mean when I say that. And for some reason, they lied about she being his daughter, which is a big mistake. It's just a mistake to lie. And for whatever reason, people of my generation who knew that, we let them get away with that. I don't know why, but we said, okay, it's not a biggie. But she was not his daughter. And so I do want to mention that because that is kind of terrible. And Paul Bragg also claimed that he started the first health food stores in 1912, but that, of course, is also not true. Why? Because in the 1840s, there were health food stores in New York City and on the East Coast, and they were called Graham, they were called Reform Food Groceries. And there were also houses people lived who practiced vegetarianism and the ideas of Sylvester Graham, and they were called Graham boarding houses. And that's, oh, you're going to love this. Oberlin College in the 1830s was the first university in the United States that went co-ed. They went co-ed in the 1830s. They let women go to college. Oberlin, okay. So they were progressive. They were in Ohio. And they also had the first vegan dining hall. 1830s, those of you who are vegan here and, you know, who have been vegan or vegetarian or whatever, 1830s. And they didn't call them vegans then. They didn't have the term. So what were you called if you were vegetarian or vegan? Let's say vegan in the 18th. What were you called? What was the term for you?
I don't know.
Graham? No, good thought. No, actually, they called them Pythagoreans. Because supposedly Pythagoras was a vegan. Supposedly. So they didn't call them vegetarians. No, they called them Pythagoreans. And they had this, and they were all, it was all based on the work of Sylvester Graham. So there was someone who had the Graham Journal. He was a writer, and because Sylvester Graham at this point already was not active. So they hired this guy, and he came to the college, and he put together a vegan program. But he was so strict, and he wouldn't allow any spices at all, no coffee, no tea, no alcohol, certainly no meat, of course. And so people said, okay, no, we hate this, you know. They wouldn't do it, you know. So there was a rebellion. They fired him, and then they put an end to it. But they were called Pythagoreans, which I think is great. So let me just, so in the 1970s, in the late 60s, in 1969, I became vegan. Because I had bad skin, you know, I wanted to have good skin. So I thought, okay, I just won't eat that anymore. So I became vegan. And then after college, I worked for Ann Wigmore. I'm very proud of that. Ann Wigmore, who, with Victoria Sklavinskas, Ann was responsible for wheatgrass, sprouting, and raw foods. And I worked for Ann and Victoria Sklavinskas, and Ann wrote Why Suffer, Be Your Own Doctor, the wheatgrass book. And Victor wrote Survival into the 21st Century, which when it came out in 1975, was the book for the raw food vegan movement. It was a great book, and the front cover was done by Peter Max. Peter Max, who we all know who Peter Max is, but in the 70s, Peter was huge. I mean, his commercial drawings were on the phone book. They were everywhere. And he was a nice guy, Peter. And anyway, Peter's second wife, Liz Max, came to Hippocrates, and I introduced Victor to Liz Max. Now, Victor Sklavinskas, he was from Lithuania. And Ann Wigmore was also from Lithuania. And this is funny, but also true. The Lithuanians, Ann and Victor, like to take credit for fermented foods. They claimed that the Lithuanians introduced fermented food to the world, which I think is not true, but, you know, they certainly use fermented food because I think people have been using fermented food for thousands of years, and so I'm not sure where it started, but the Lithuanians are into it. And I'm saying that not to sound silly, but because, you know, people tell you various things, and sometimes you reject things. You think, well, that just wasn't turned out not to be true. But what Sklavinskas did and Ann Wigmore did was they made fermented foods part of the healing process in the 60s and 70s when there was, those of us who were my age, remember, there was no discussion of digestive enzymes. There was no discussion of gut flora that we take for granted. I mean, every one of us knows all about gut flora, and all the relatives who make fun of us, they also know about it. Everyone knows about it. But in the 70s, no discussion. And Sklavinskas, who was an impressive fellow, Victor was born in 1939 in Lithuania when the Germans were busy killing everybody. And when the war ended in 45, he was in a displaced persons camp with his parents until about 48. So Victor, in his early years, knew nothing but chaos, of the worst type of chaos that none of us, luckily, as Americans, can imagine. And Sklavinskas was an impressive guy. And he had such a terrible early life that supposedly, according to what Victor told me, he didn't speak until he was 15. So those of us who are adults and have children, we know that must have been pretty terrible. So Sklavinskas eventually went to the University of Connecticut, where he got a master's degree in mathematics, and he worked for NASA, and he worked for space administrations besides NASA, and he helped with rocketry. He was a brilliant guy. And he loved crappy food. Burgers. He ate burgers 3 times a day. He said so. He just, that's all he ate, was just convenience food. And he was so sick, he felt he couldn't even work anymore. And so he gave that all up to sit in the Harvard University Library and read about nutrition. And Kulvinskis was, in the 1960s, 1970s, and arguably the 1980s, the most influential raw food teacher. And then his ideas were so good, and he was such a compelling figure, that there are now hundreds of people who have a lot to say about the subject. But at one time, it was Kulvinskis. Let me throw my little piece in. So Liz Max, Peter Max's second wife, liked Victor very much, loved his presentations. And Victor used to talk about cleansing the bowel a lot, but he was from Lithuania, and so English was his second language. So when Victor would talk about the colon, he would always talk about debris in the colon, debris in the colon. And I would say to him after the lectures, I say, no, Vic, it's debris in the colon, Vic. And he would go, oh, Joshua, thank you, debris in the colon. And next time he gave a lecture, because I always went with him, it was always debris in the colon. So but he was great. He was a genuine article. He was just a remark, and he knew a ton. He was just unbelievable, really. And I was there for 2 years, and he was just a fantastic person. And so was Anne. There was nothing bad to say about them. Those two were remarkable healers. They were great people, and they had enormous influence. Enormous. No one really knows the name so much now. Maybe this crowd a little bit, but those two were remarkable in the with fermented food. And again, Kulvinskis, more than anybody else, he translated the work of Dr. Edward Howell, M.D. Howell's work was about 60 years old. It was not used. Kulvinskis, he didn't translate it. That was wrong. He had it reprinted. He contacted Dr. Howell, who's a very old man, had it reprinted. So before that, there was no discussion about digestive enzymes, about gut flora, none. Kulvinskis, with his use of fermented food, and Anne Wigmore, her Juvelac, they were the major people teaching that. No one else was really teaching. Others were teaching vegetarianism. They were talking veganism. Some people were talking fruitarian. They were talking breatharian. There was Johnny Lubberstam. There was all sorts of people. I agree. But no one had the science background that Kulvinskis had. And with he and with Anne were remarkably important. They were great, and also, and I once again say this, on a personal level, they were really very fantastic people. So it was great to work there and see this. It's one thing to read it in a book. You know, I'm in the suburbs, I'm reading a book, I think this works, it seems to be working on me. But when you go to his clinic in Boston, and you saw it was working on thousands of people, because I was there for 2 years, people come all over, and in those days, let me mention this, so we're in California. So in California, what did we have in the 1960s and 1970s? We had Esalen Institute. Everyone knows about Esalen? We had Esalen? Okay. Esalen Institute was probably in the world at that point the foremost center for maybe psychology, growth in psychology, which is constantly evolving, and maybe discussion of spiritual work. And so Esalen was great. They were great, and they did a lot of good stuff. But on the East Coast, in my opinion, based on my experience, I would say that Hippocrates was the major center because there were very few. It was Hippocrates, because Hippocrates. Now, in Florida, there was a place called. Has anyone ever heard of Shangri-La? The Shangri-La Hygienic Institute in Bonita Springs, Florida. They did the work of Herbert Shelton. Everyone knows. Does anyone know who Herbert Shelton is? Herbert Shelton, only one person. What's your first name again?
Nastasha.
Okay, Herbert. Now, in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, Herbert Shelton was the most influential teacher. He really was the most influential teacher. Now, as a young man, what did Shelton do when he was a young guy? How many of us know Bernard McFadden? Bernard McFadden. Okay. Bernard McFadden was a publisher, and he was a bodybuilder in 1900, and he was a weightlifter, and he had the brains to publish the first Hollywood magazines, the first gossip magazines, and modern romance magazines. And he made a ton of money publishing that easy-to-read stuff we all like to read. And he also published health publications. And he came out with his five-volume encyclopedia of health in the early 20s. Bernard McFadden is the... So that was Bernard McFadden, who was... He ran for governor of New York State, always lost. He ran for senator, always lost. And he, during the 30s, when there was eugenics going on, we're trying to make master people. So some things were discarded. Okay. So they would have these contests for the most beautiful young girls and young boys that he would sponsor. This was in the 30s. A lot of stuff was going on in the 30s. Okay. Anyway, so Bernard McFadden was very influential. And then Herbert Shelton in the 50s and 60s. Now, I used to read Herbert Shelton. How many of you here used to follow what was called food combining? Did anyone here follow food combining? Food combining? Okay. Now, I also follow food combining. And that was from Shelton's book, Superior Nutrition. And he had a little tiny book called Food Combining Made Easy, which as a girl you might remember reading Food Combining Made Easy. Okay, so I followed all that. And let me say this now. You can't always call everything correctly. So food combining means, you know, you don't want to mix foods together because according to Shelton, they didn't combine well. So if you ate fruit, supposed to eat fruit at a fruit meal, and if you were going to eat melons, you had to eat melons by themselves because they didn't combine with other things. Now, as it turns out, I follow food combining so much that I used to have paragraphs of his book memorized. Paragraphs memorized because I would reread it all the time. So I'm kind of proud of that in a silly way. I was a teenage boy, and I thought, oh, this guy Shelton, I love him. But what I didn't realize was what I thought was science wasn't science. No. It was kind of a movement, and it was philosophical in nature to a large extent. And I bought into that. And the same thing with the vegan movement. Because I was vegetarian from age 16 to age 48. Now, I was vegan from age 16 to, from 1969 to 1977, but that was vegetarian, and I just didn't want to do it anymore. Then I was vegetarian until I was 48, and I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't want to. Okay. So I gave it a fair shot. But what I thought in the 60s about being vegetarian and vegan was, oh, no, this is good science. This is good science. But I was wrong. Why was I wrong? Because in 1969 or 1975, there was no discussion that the vegan diet is lacking in B12. You know, now you can take a supplement, which vegans do now, but it's lacking. So I thought I was following the vegan diet because I wanted to be a healthy guy. That's really all I wanted. Okay, but as it turned out, I was wrong. And then it wasn't until about the late 70s when there was discussion in the scientific literature that the vegan diet lacks EPA and DHA, which we need for cognition and beautiful and healthy vision and heart and skin, which we get from eating fish. Because we're humans, and we are smart, and we live on the coast because the climate is more moderate, and we can catch fish, and we can eat clams and mussels and all sorts of things because we are humans and we're fish eaters. Now, today, the oceans are polluted, and so we might decide, I'm not eating fish anymore. I'd like to, but I think not a good idea. Okay. But theoretically, we are fish eaters. And let me say this too. Again, I was vegan for a long time and vegetarian for a long time, and I thought that was science, but my opinion now is that was not science on my part. I thought it was science. It was a philosophical position. I was happy to buy in, but I thought it was science, but it was really a philosophical position. Okay, which is okay, but it wasn't science, so I was wrong about that. Now, let's say we have friends, and they say, no, we're vegetarian, we're vegan. Josh, we think you're a nice person, but you're wrong. Okay, so let me ask this question. This is an empirical question. So what traditional cultures have been, let's just say vegan, let's just say vegetarian. So the vegetarians, they use milk, they eat eggs, they eat milk and eggs, but they're not vegan. So what traditional cultures have been either vegan or vegetarian? The answer is none. None. Individual men and women, philosophers, Aristotle, Plato, okay, fine. They were intellectuals. They were vegetarian. Okay. But the Romans weren't. The Greeks weren't. The ancient Chinese weren't. The Japanese weren't. No one was. So really, the vegetarian thing, I don't want this to sound too harsh, it's a philosophical construct, which is okay, but it's not science. And I say that as someone who was vegan and then vegetarian for a long time, and proudly so, and I thought it was good for me. It was because it was good to watch what I was eating. And also, back in the 60s and 70s, you couldn't go anywhere and get anything to eat. If you didn't go to a natural food store, you were screwed. I'm from the East Coast, so we had grocery stores, A&P, Grand Union. There was nothing worth eating there. And I would come home and I'd be upset. I couldn't find anything that wanted, because I'd buy peaches or apples, and I hated the way they tasted. And my mother and father, they meant well too. But they said, "Well, what's your problem? I don't like any of this. I don't want to eat any of this." And so they kind of looked at me like, and my father was supportive too. And my mother a little bit. My father, but they just they couldn't relate to that. And I thought, this doesn't taste good. I'm not eating this. I don't like it. And I didn't know what to eat. And it was quite upsetting, by the way. It now it seems kind of humorous, but really at the time it wasn't humorous. I thought, am I that wacky, really? I don't feel that wacky. Let's see. I'm not drinking alcohol. I'm not using drugs. I'm not smoking cigarettes. And so you're criticizing me because I'm not drinking Coca-Cola? In essence, that was what, I felt bad about it then. That's why I mention it now, 50 years later. I felt bad about it. I didn't like being seen as a dummy because they didn't think I was a dummy. And I thought, listen, this is just food. I'm not talking about esoteric stuff here. I'm not reading Aristotle. I don't know anything about Nietzsche. I'm not paying any attention to any of that. I'm not pretending that I know any of that at all. I don't. I'm eating fresh food, and this I'm being attacked for eating fresh food. Let me just mention this go back to the 70s. So I was working for Ann and Victor at Hippocrates in Boston, and the head of Tufts University, his name just escaped me, but he wrote a book called Panic in the Pantry, in which he attacked the natural foods crowd, us, he attacked us. And he was the head of Tufts Nutrition Department, so he'd get a lot of ground with that terrible book. And his book came out about a year after Dick Gregory's book came out. Does anyone remember Dick Gregory? Dick Gregory, yeah. Dick Gregory wrote a book called Cooking with Mother Nature. So Dick Gregory was let me just mention about Dick Gregory, because he's important. He was the first black comedian to work what he said was flat-footed. He worked at the Chicago Playboy Club. I'm not saying Hugh Hefner was a good person, because he turned out to be a dirtbag, and none of us knew that then. But he hired Dick Gregory to fill in when Professor Irwin Corey, those of us who are my age know who that is, he was a comedian who was actually pretty funny, couldn't make it. So he had Dick Gregory fill in at the Chicago Playboy Club, and as Dick likes to say about it, he worked flat-footed. That is, he didn't sing, he didn't dance, he was in a white nightclub, and he was telling jokes about segregation. Not exactly lighthearted, Las Vegas fair, talking about drinking, gambling, and women with big breasts. That was not, that humor might be funny too. He didn't do that. He talked about segregation. And Dick Gregory wrote a book called Cooking with Mother Nature, and Dick Gregory was so influential. Let me just mention about Dick Gregory. It's one thing if one of us can do something in one area of life in which people think, oh yeah, you did a good job on that. What did Dick Gregory do? So he broke the color line, and in college, he was a college athlete. He was a great runner because he was a poor boy from the middle of the country. Had no money, so he couldn't do much of anything, he didn't feel. But what he could do was he could run. He could run, didn't cost him any money, he ran. So he was so good in college, he got a scholarship. But he noticed when he was in college that the other black athletes weren't getting good academic courses to take. They gave him these little puff classes because they didn't think they were going to go anywhere, and they didn't really want him to graduate, just wanted to do well in events so they could get money from donors. And Dick Gregory, as a young guy, he was in college, he said, no, this stinks. I'm not being part. So he quit. He quit. He had a scholarship. He quit. And he was a comedian, and he fully, 4 years, what's the name of that comedian who was so funny, who he was on I Spy with Robert Culp? Bill Cosby. 4 years before Bill Cosby, Dick Gregory broke the color line. And then Dick Gregory also was involved with civil rights. So I'm proud. I have a radio show, I've told you, I'm proud of it. I play in Boston, Seattle, Las Vegas. I'm very proud of that. I had Dick Gregory on my show. And Dick Gregory talked about being in Alabama, and he was there with his wife, and she was pregnant, and a white racist kicking his wife in the stomach. So he told that on my show. And luckily, I had the brains to get him to come on my show, and so I just didn't talk, because I figured Dick Gregory doesn't know me from Adam. And after Dick said that his wife was kicked in the stomach, pregnant wife, he knew what he'd do next. He told a joke. Because he recognized when you hear something as powerful and as terrible as that, you know, people can't take too much of that. And then he would tell a joke. He was just fantastic. And the only other time I met Dick before that was in 1974, he lectured in Boston, and Victor and I went to see him lecture in BU. And when the lecture was over, Victor didn't have a car at that point. I didn't have a car. So Dick and his driver take us back to Hippocrates. So Dick Gregory had this big, heavy driver who drove us back to Hippocrates. So that's my Dick Gregory celebrity story. I have one celebrity story in my whole life, and that's it, Dick Gregory. And Dick Gregory wrote Cooking with Mother Nature. So he was involved with civil... Oh, by the way, in 63, the March on Washington, in which Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, and we've all seen those photos. It was an enormous gathering. So Bill Cosby, he paid for the sound system. You might know that. He paid for the sound system. Anyway, so Dick Gregory was very influential in civil rights, with nutrition, and with entertainment, because, again, he broke the color line. So that's just my little Dick Gregory thing. And he was a great nutritionist and an athlete. And Victoris Glavinskas, now Dick Gregory ran across the country 900 miles for peace, and Glavinskas was his nutritional expert. So Victor worked with Dick. So you have all the, once again, as in the 19th century, all the movements kind of ran together. This is kind of rambling a little bit, but I want to give you a sense of what we represent, what we are, what we're part of. We are part of a mass movement. Let me just mention, throw one final thing in, because I think this is just amazing. So I have this radio show, which I'm very proud of, and I had Robert F. Kennedy on my show in the height of the pandemic, and I knew who I had on my show, so I gave him the whole 48 minutes of the show, and I was very respectful. I kept calling him Mr. Kennedy, because I'd seen some videos that he had done. He was lecturing at various places, and people would call him Bobby. They called him Bobby, and I'm thinking to myself, well, he's not my friend. Thank goodness I got him to come on my show, so I just let him talk. And Kennedy is interesting because he is not like us. He's not a wellness person. I don't know what he's eating. I don't know what he's doing with himself. But he's not us. He doesn't have a wellness orientation. No, Kennedy was an environmentalist. He was at Pace University, and he helped clean up the Hudson River and tributaries. And he and his team of talented people around him sued the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and General Motors and General Electric. Do you know in the 70s, General Motors had a factory, and when they were finished painting cars, if they had extra paint, they just took the paint and threw it right in the Hudson River. They didn't even pretend that they were going to process it. And Kennedy put a stop to that. Now, at first, everyone hated him the way they hate environmentalists. You know, I remember in 1970, I'm from New York, and so New York City, you know, it's a major spot, New York City. I remember watching TV in 1970. I was home from college. And there were two newscasters. It was a man and woman newscaster. And so with the newscasters, you know, they're always like handsome guys, good-looking women. Great. The men are wearing great outfits. Women have great outfits, you know. And I remember it was 1970. And these two newscasters were sneering at Earth Day as though it was just the lowest goddamn stuff. Earth Day. Who would be involved with that, they were thinking. And this was the New York. Now, again, New York is pretty cool, but so I'm not making it from Alabama, but I wasn't in Alabama. I was in New York. And this was the attitude of the mainstream popular press about Earth Day in 1970. And I remember, and I was resentful then, and I'm resentful now of that, because that's the way they portray us. And they continue to portray us that way. And Kennedy kind of changed that. Because Kennedy and the team of people around him, who tend to be women, attorneys who have vaccine-damaged children, and those women attorneys are women my age, and their vaccine-damaged children are now grown men who require 24-hour, 7-day-a-week care, and there's nothing joyful or gracious about that. It's murder every day. And Kennedy didn't want to deal with vaccines. He didn't want to. Eventually, one woman who's a PhD gave him a stack of scientific literature, and Kennedy said on my show and other shows, he likes to read science, he read the literature, and he knew there were problems with vaccination. And so Kennedy, not a wellness guy, an environmentalist, which is a branch of wellness, he grudgingly took up the vaccine issue. And when you see it on TV, whenever they talk about Kennedy, here's what Kennedy's opposed to. Robert F. Kennedy is opposed to, and his team, Children's Health Defense, they don't want aluminum, formaldehyde, mercury, or polyethylene glycol allowed in vaccines. We're not even talking about the mRNA vaccines. Let's just talk about other vaccines. He says, no, no, they can't be allowed. Now, the Japanese banned mercury in their vaccines in the 80s. In the 80s. Now, they're an advanced industrial nation. So were we. They banned it in the 80s. Now, if you gave Kennedy 15 seconds on NBC News or ABC, he could say that. No, no, they never give him the chance. They always say, ah, Kennedy, his family doesn't agree with him. That's what they say over and over. His family doesn't, okay, so if you fight with your family, that's unfortunate. But why don't we deal with the issues? But they won't. No, they have to make it personal. Because if they talked about, well, you think mercury, formaldehyde, aluminum are bad? Okay, then you have to open up the debate. They don't want to talk about it. And let me say this too about Children's Health Defense. I like to think that I know my subject of wellness. I think I'm pretty good. But I realize it's a huge subject, and you can only know this much. There's so much to know. And here's what Children's Health Defense did. They have a guy working for them. His name is Harold Gillo. And Harold Gillo is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps. And in the 80s, when he was serving overseas, they gave him some. They made him take these vaccines that made him sick. So he figured, huh, I'm sick, and maybe from these vaccines. So he investigated, and he found out he was allergic to polyethylene glycol. Now I, in all the years I've been reading about vaccination, I thought I knew something, had never even heard of polyethylene glycol. And I thought, whoa. And here's one guy, Harold Gillo, a military man. Because of him, we all know about polyethylene glycol now. So Kennedy, not a wellness guy, suddenly, in my opinion, has tremendously expanded the people who agree with us. All of a sudden, we're a lot less lonely. Now, I don't know how many more millions of people he added, but I'm guessing, this is a guess, that maybe there are 10% or 15% more Americans now who get it, what we're talking about, than there were, say, 3 or 4 years ago. That's an amazing change that no one could have ever seen, because this is my subject. And I hang out with guys who talk about this all the time. This is all we talk about. This is our subject. We like it. It's fun. But Kennedy really changed things. And I mentioned this, we were chatting. For the first time as a third-party candidate, he's the first one in living memory that I know of who is equally liked or disliked by Republicans, Democrats, and Libertarians. Because if you go back to, say, 2000, when Ralph Nader ran, he probably drew mostly from progressives, and so the Republicans won't beat Gore. And if you go back before that, we had Ross Perot, who probably was appealing much more to conservatives, and so he, taking both votes away from Bush, allowed Clinton to get in. So it's hard to know what's going to happen. You know, none of us can really tell. I can't read the future. But Kennedy is drawing from everyone. And something I also mentioned when we were chatting earlier is both political parties are not good when it comes to health care. Because if you're a senator, you can't know about every subject. So you go to your advisors, and your advisors for health care are MDs, and the MDs say this. And so you might think, well, Josh, you're a nice guy. I'm not listening to you. I'm talking to these MDs. Are you an MD? No, go take a hike then. So it's not his fault. And it doesn't matter if he's Republican or Democrat, because they're all the same. You know. So I say that because I know this group has a, you know, have interest in politics. But as far as I can tell, both political parties are not good. They are both almost completely not good, but there are individual men and women in each party that are good. I mentioned Senator Tom Harkin, who's no longer in Senate. And his wife was real sick with cancer in the 70s. And he found out about, I use the term nature cure we're talking about here today. And so he realized, my God, this actually works. And in Utah, there was Orrin Hatch, who was very good with healthcare. Orrin Hatch was great, as a matter of fact. I think he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was great too. So we had a Democrat, Harkin, and we had the conservative, Orrin Hatch, who were both great. So, and then there were some also congressmen that were helpful, but really, both other the parties, no, they're not good. Individual men and women are good in the parties. That's my take on it. But the parties, they're not any better. Anyway, so I guess that's kind of enough. Any questions? But thank you very much, and thank you for listening, because I really do like this. I like talking about it. And I think I kind of gave an overview. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joshua. So anyone that has a question, come on up to the microphone.
Yeah, thanks.
And try to make it just brief and a quick question.
Yeah. Thanks.
Will be a quick question.
By the way, how long did I speak for? Was that forever? How long was that?
An hour 15.
Oh, that's a huge amount of time. Thank you for listening to that. I tell you, I really love the subject. I just love it. I'm happy to have an audience. I just love it. And the more let me say this, this is all very practical too. You know, we all want to be strong and healthy. We all want that. And, you know, when you're 20, we were chatting about this. When you're 20, we can all be wise guys, right? We can all be very cavalier. We're 20. We're beautiful. We're strong. We can do whatever we want. We pretty much think, okay, that's great when you're 20. I'm 72. You get to be older, and your body doesn't cooperate. And it's very depressing because you think every goddamn day, this hurts, this hurts, this hurts. There's nothing glorious about it. There's nothing heroic about it. There's nothing. It just drags you down. And when you eat carefully and take care of yourself, you avoid all that. So 7 days a week, you want to play golf and tennis and work, you can do it. That's what you get. Whereas your family and friends, nice people, very nice people, but they don't get it. So they think, oh no, this just hurts. I'm going to have that tip taken out. I'll put a plastic hip in. I'll put plastic in here. You know, I'll put this, you know. Okay. So they suffer. And so we probably done a little suffering. That's probably why I got into nutrition. But then we realize, oh my God, that's what I get. You lose all that fear. So, because if you're in the bathroom in the morning and you stub your toe and your toe hurts, you think, oh, I stubbed my toe. I'm an idiot. But you're not worried about it because you know, my toe hurts. I just stubbed it. It's not, you think, oh my God, am I diabetic? Do I have heart disease? No, you don't have any of that. So that's what you get. This is a very practical subject. And I once again, thank you for inviting me. Thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have a question. So I'm asking as a PhD in molecular biology, still doing research, have been doing research for 30 years.
Yes.
And you mentioned several times science. It has not been... That has not been shown by science, like vegan diet has been not proven by science. Right. So you've been talking about science. Are you aware that in scientific research we do not use the scientific method? Are you aware of the scientific method that is not used in any scientific research? That's my question.
Yeah,
when you mentioned science.
I really can't answer that question. I do not know the subject. I've got a bachelor's degree in history,
because
cum laude, you know, so, but on science, I know squat. And so I don't pretend to know anything.
So
now, let me just say that on the science, you know, what was the famous China study? That was the famous book?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So, but he, what was the name of that author?
T. Colin Campbell.
Yeah. And that book was very popular. He was on Oprah, and he was great. But of course, he got to pick and choose his ideas. And let me offer a criticism now. So
I was just asking.
Yeah, so
what I want to know.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Again, as a scientist that has been doing science for 30 years, I'm asking you: are you aware that in science we do not use what's called the scientific method, which is the method that should be used to demonstrate something?
No, I don't really know that.
So,
I just don't know.
So this is my point.
Yeah.
A lot of people that throw around science, are not aware of that. So all of the scientific papers should be put into garbage. The ones that are supporting vegan diet as the diet for humans to be healthy, and the other ones that do not support the vegan diet. I'm just picking the vegan diet
because I'm a vegan. Right.
So I'm just telling you that let's stop throwing around science, scientific papers, because it's all garbage.
Okay.
And then I also want to know, do you still support germ theory? Because you mentioned tonsils being part of lymphatic system, which is now part of immune system.
Right.
Immune system is as much garbage as vitamins.
Okay.
All right. Vitamins is another point. Vitamins have never been proven to exist. So B12 lacking in vegans is a hoax.
Okay, listen, so...
That's just my comment.
No, you have background, I do not have, and so
yeah.
I'm listening.
So I wanted
I
to point
not,
out...
I'm sorry, I cannot rebut you intelligent, I just do not know.
Okay.
But let me offer this. There are men of my generation, Michael Clapper, Neil Bernard, MDs, mm-hmm. you probably all know of them, who are vegan advocates. Now, when I was a young man in the 70s, and they were young men in the 70s, they were just a little older than me, I liked them. I read them. I liked them. But what happened as I got older and I stopped being vegetarian, and I would see Michael Clapper or Neil Bernard or other talented guys who I liked. I thought that somehow their message had changed. It was no longer the vegan thing or vegetarian thing for health. It was now more philosophical, and they became very kind of cranky and angry when people would say, well, what about the lack of B12 in the vegan diet? Naturally, well, we can take supplements. Yeah, but still, dietary-wise, we're lacking it. And what about the EPA-DHA thing, which people didn't know until about 1979? And so I was became then aware that indeed what I thought was science, you know, was correct theory, was really philosophical, which is okay. But I'm concerned now that guys like Michael Clapper, who, again, I respect, and Neil Barnard, who I certainly respect. I respect both those men have been on my show, by the way. Neil Barnard was out less than a month ago. And so I like their work, and they've got backgrounds. They have also, I don't know any of it. But really, I'm just concerned. Now, again, that's just a question on my part. It's a question on my part about what is veganism? Is it just a philosophical construct, or is it really straight ahead, physiologically, what we should be doing? Because if people say, oh, monkeys, you know, they're all a vegetarian, that's not true. Because we know that monkeys and great apes, they occasionally eat smaller monkeys, and they eat animals once in a while. They catch them and eat them. So they're not vegans. We know they're not vegans.
We didn't evolve from monkeys.
Right. No, I'm not saying we did either, by the way. I don't have the science background. But I'm saying, but some people bring up, they say, look at the great apes and stuff. They're vegetarian. But of course, they're not. They're not vegetarian. I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I've got a couple of things I wanted to ask you about that's not of the weighty nature of what she's talking about.
Well, see, I don't have that background. And you know, I don't. And of course, that is something, so it really, it's an issue because I'm lacking a huge chunk of stuff. But I am good in my area, that's all.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm going to ask you about your area. Okay. I'm really curious about the acne when it went away.
Yeah.
Did that improve your love life?
That's a very, very fair question. Let me say it improved my self-image.
Well, that's number one.
Yeah, improved my self-image. Because it really, you know, the skin, because, you know, by the way, this is not a joke. Teenagers have a high level of suicide than the rest of us because one of the major areas is when their skin breaks out, the teenagers are so depressed about it. That's not a joke. You can look that up. Teenagers kill themselves over the fact that they are not happy with their appearance. So that's just terrible. But, you know, that's the way it is. So it was good for me to have better skin. And also it was good for me to realize every time I do A, B happens. I could see cause and effect. I could say, okay, Joshua, you're going to sit down today and overeat, and you're going to eat too many almonds. Okay, Josh, and your skin's going to break out. Because I just couldn't handle the fat. You know, little gallbladder.
So it improved your self-respect.
Well, self-respect, but also I got to see every time I do this, this happens. So for me, the food thing was very clear.
You were years ahead of everybody else.
No, I wasn't ahead. I just, for example, again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not a musician, but I love pop music. I love music, right?
Me too.
But I'm not a musician. I don't seem to get it. I don't seem to have the drive to learn it, but I like it. But in nutrition, for some reason, that is my area. I know it sounds terribly egotistical. I'm good at this. I'm good at this. This is the one thing I'm good at.
I got two more things, but I just want to tell you about it. If you like pop music, you want to go to rewoundradio.com.
Which one?
Rewoundradio.com. Okay. They play all of the other ones. They're DJs from the past, and the guys that did all the commercials for all the pop stations are on there.
Okay.
You'll love it.
Okay.
The second thing
let me just jump in here, sir. So on my radio show, because I see nutrition as being mainstream, who did I have on my show? I had Eddie Brigati of the Young Rascals on my show.
Okay.
He was fantastic. I had Tom Paxton, the folk singer, who I loved. Who else? Oh, yes. Norman Greenbaum wrote Spirit in the Sky, big hit in 1970.
Right.
I had Melanie on, who had a brand new pair of roller skates.
Yeah, yeah.
She was great. So, and they're my generation. Oh, let me tell you this. She just passed away. Wait. Here's a story. I think you'll like this. People say, well, Joshua, why would you have rock and rollers on your show? You're doing a wellness show. I said, well, my attitude is because wellness is mainstream now, and the rock and rollers I like are people of my generation. But the young ones, you know, Taylor Swift, I know the name, but I have no idea about the work, you know, I don't know. But my generation, I know the work, and I like the work, and I like to critique the work. Okay, so Melanie, get this about Melanie. Melanie, who I really like, but when I was a teenager, I listened to her songs. I didn't, you know, I got a brand new pair of roller skates.
Right.
Okay, I was a cute song. Okay, so Melanie's mom was a jazz singer in the village in the 50s and early 60s. So Melanie would go with her mom. And so Melanie absorbed all this influence. And Melanie said when she was a girl, all the older girls who were folk singers, she said, and this is what she said on my show, she said they were all angular, meaning they were slim, good-looking girls, right? Okay. And she felt that she was not angular. Okay. This was her take on herself. So she decides, this is nutrition now, she's going to remedy that. She flies out to Escondido, California, where she goes to Bernard Jensen's ranch. How many of us here know Bernard Jensen? Bernard Jensen. Bernard Jensen, a man of my mom and dad's generation, a very influential healer who had a big ranch in Escondido where he did fasting, but he was known for iridology, the science of looking at the iris of the eye and seeing health problems, which is legitimate science. It's not like phrenology. You know, it's legitimate science. And also, let me tell you, this is going to love this story too. Once again, nutrition and spirituality, which we see with Mary Baker Eddy and, Seventh-day Adventists and all the other. Okay. But there's always been kind of a tie-in. There's just a tie-in, whatever reason. Okay. So I'm in favor of that, actually. Bernard Jensen was getting to be older. He had a big piece of property in Escondido. And he didn't need all of it, so he decided to sell some of it. And who did he sell it to? Who wanted it? Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi. Autobiography of a Yogi, very possibly the most influential spiritual book in English of the 20th century. I could be wrong about that. I haven't read that many spiritual books, but I've read, Be Here Now by Ram Dass was a great textbook, but really it wasn't first person the way Autobiography of a Yogi was. So he sold his land to Paramahansa Yogananda, who had a site there. So I thought, fantastic, fantastic. I was so thrilled when I learned that. I thought, oh my God, I just love that story. Anyway, so Melanie is out in Escondido, and she's fasting with Bernard Jensen on water. And she fasts for 27 days on water, which is pretty radical. I'm not saying I recommend that. That's what she wants her to do. Okay, so then Jensen says, that's enough. He breaks her fast. She flies back to Jersey, where she's from, where she's living with her hubby. He's a record producer. And they go antiquing. She liked to go antiquing, she and her hubby. And after they finished antiquing, she's very hungry. She's finished a 27-day fast on water. She pulls into a McDonald's. She eats burgers, fries, and thick shake. And she's making fun of it. You know, she's eating all this. She knows better. She's eating all this terrible crap. And she's sitting in the car eating this crap. And she's writing, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key. And she's writing this. And she's written down. And her husband says, what are you doing? She says, oh, I'm writing. He says, tell me. And he says, I got a brand new pair. And she says, oh, it's just crap. He says, no, I like that. I like that. So based on whatever story she's telling, either that day or the next day, he drags her into the studio. And she records, I got a brand new pair of roller skates, which was her biggest hit. But it was a cute song. It was kind of what they call double entendre. You know, it was based on 1930s kind of song. So it was like a little bit of girlish sexuality and pop music, you know. And there wasn't that much of it. There wasn't that much female sexuality being talked in pop music. And it was a big hit for her. But she was a sharp person. She was always a little resentful that that was her big hit song because she felt she had other better songs, and she wanted me to know that she had better songs than that. And I already knew she did because I did my research before I had her show. And she was very happy to say that Nina Simone recorded her songs. Wow. Now, she was very happy to tell me Nina Simone recorded my songs and Ray Charles recorded her songs. And then I also mentioned to her, yes, and Mata Hoople recorded your songs as well. I like Mata Hoople. And anyway, so that's how I was able to tie in rock and roll and nutrition. I thought, great. And everyone loves rock and roll stories. They're just fun for our generation. You know, they're fun. But we talk about Taylor Swift. You know, I'm happy to hear about Taylor Swift, but I have no emotional connection. You know what I mean? But Dylan or Donovan or the Beatles or the Stones, I like it. That's all. Anyway, so that's how I worked it in. And by the way, I'm having Tom Rush on in a couple of weeks, Tom Rush. And also one of the guys from Foghat. You know Foghat?
Yeah. Let's
take a slow ride. He's going to be on in a couple of weeks too. So like, I'm real proud of myself. I think to myself, hey, I get to talk to these people. I get to talk to the guy from Foghat. I mean, I'm thrilled. Who am I trying to kid? I'm thrilled. I got to talk to Eddie Brigati. Eddie Brigati of the Young Rascals. And you know how the Rascals became big stars? Because Eddie had an older brother named David. And what was he in? He was in Joey D and the Starlighters, Peppermint Twist. That was an international hit in 60 and 61. That was the older brother, David. So that's how they got rolling, the Young Rascals. And they were great. I used to watch them on Ed Sullivan. I think they were on 7 times on Ed Sullivan.
They're still great.
So for my generation, that's a big deal.
They're still great.
Yeah. Yes, I think so, too.
I heard one today on the radio show, that Rewind Radio, was Sylvia's mother. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah, that was still. Yeah, I know that. I know that was crap.
They play all this stuff. Yeah. Anyway, let's get on with the rest of this questions here. I have a kind of a comment and then just an additional question, a short one. You were talking about people kind of illiterate early back in there. They didn't read very much in the early 1800s.
Yeah.
I would contend with you right now that we've returned to illiteracy in the country. I don't think people read that much either. And they don't want to read a book. They can't read a book. Most of the kids coming out, they just don't have any level of comprehension.
Well, but we have public schools now. We didn't have public schools in the 19th century.
True.
Remember, we did not. We have free public education in the United States now. But in the 19th century, when we had waves of Italian and Polish and Greek immigrants who were Catholic, the nativist Americans did not want to provide free education because they did not want to educate the Catholic masses.
Right.
So that is a historical fact. I'm just mentioning that now because that's just the way it was. But we have free public education now. Now, not in every school is good, but so people now can read where they couldn't read in 1930. People didn't read. Now people read. And when someone doesn't read, we think, wow, that guy doesn't read.
Well, they don't get a lot about reading. Anyway, next thing. Synanon. Were you associated with Synanon in any way? Were they involved in anything besides drug rehab? I thought they were doing nutrition for a while as well.
If I just know the name. I haven't heard the name in 50 years, but I remember they were briefly there. I don't know anything about them. Why, were you involved with them?
I went. Of course, I had liberal teachers in the 70s in college, female teachers, and who dragged us down to Synanon to see this great commune thing. And Chuck Dietrich, the only thing I know about him is that he was most famous for his statement, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life." He's the guy that coined that phrase.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting. Anyway. I remember that was a popular statement. I haven't heard that in a long time either. Okay.
Yeah. But I liked it because it was on the beach down there in Santa Monica, so it was kind of nice. Anyway,
I was East Coast, so I didn't come out until the late 70s.
Well, the Army helped me, travel quite a bit. I was stuck here. Good spot. Thanks. Okay.
Any other questions? Oh, let me just, before we wrap it up, I'll take a question. Let me say, so you know, I have a wellness radio show. If anyone needs a card, please give you my card.
Are you going to talk about pop music?
Please take a card. A little bit on the show. But my show plays on AM/FM radio in Boston, Seattle, Las Vegas, Albuquerque, Riverside, San Bernardino. I'm very proud of that. So it's on Google and Apple, you know, the major, but also it's on AM/FM radio because people driving in the car, you know, they turn it on. I think they might find it amusing. I'm hoping they do. But I'm trying to, because as much as we talked about today, I see myself as being very, very mainstream, especially when I'm talking to this crowd. Everyone kind of knows, gets a lot of it. We all know different things other people don't know. But, like, I think my subject is mainstream now, and so I want to be on AM/FM radio. And I'm very proud of people I pick on the show, and they're people that most of you already know who they are. Maybe you heard them speak or read their book, because nutrition is mainstream. But every subject needs to be spoken about and needs to be promoted. That just has to, because you're fighting in the marketplace of ideas, and you got to put your ideas forward. And if your ideas are good, they'll be picked up by more and more people, that's all. Yes, thank you. Thanks for waiting. Thank you.
This question may be more boring than the other question. First of all, I'm your age. I'm also 72, turned 72 in January.
You graduated from high school in 69?
69, yeah.
Me too.
Yep. So we grew up during the same era. You probably grew up in New York.
East Coast, yeah.
East Coast.
I went to Woodstock.
Oh, man, I'm so jealous. I did get to see the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl in 1965.
That must have been fantastic.
That was incredible. Oh my God, yeah. You couldn't hear anything. Everybody was screaming.
Right. But even so,
but
it's fantastic.
It was,
good for you.
Pretty amazing.
Good for you.
Saw the Rolling Stones out here at the Forum, Los Angeles Forum. I didn't even know that.
What year was that?
That was in the 70s after I graduated. But anyway, so I cannot seem to stop watching videos about castor oil. And I figured you might have some interesting castor oil stories and information. I've been using it on my skin. It helps with the wrinkles. But, you know, and it's not really nutrition as much as it is.
No, it's nutrition.
Well, I know, but a lot of people talk about not taking castor oil internally. So tell me whatever you want to say about castor oil.
I know very little about castor oil. I think it's great for the skin topically. I think it can be used for hair quality, good for the hair. I think it can be taken internally to cleanse the bowel. I think it's a good and legitimate oil to use and has a long history of use. I don't have any downside, although you do want to make sure that you get a legitimate brand, because there's always some concern about adulteration of products, the way we all know that you buy olive oil and you pay a lot of money for the olive oil, and what you're getting is mostly olive oil, and maybe they're mixing in soy oil, whatever they're mixing in, whatever they can make a profit on. So we have to watch the quality of products. But other than that, I think castor oil is good. It's good. It's one of those home remedies that's legitimate, that people can make fun of all they want. It works.
It works for all kinds of things.
It works.
All kinds of things. Yeah. Hexane-free, organic.
Right. Yeah,
bottled in brown glass.
That's right. And it's better to be in glass. Glass. And you get a brand you want, like Heritage, you know, which is Edward Casey's group, was. And, you know, you want to get a good brand. Oracacia is very good. You know, as long as you get a good brand, I think it's great. And while you mention this, you know what I'm a big fan of and only started using just 3 or 4 years ago, even though I knew about it? And this is frankincense. How many people use frankincense? Frankincense. Okay, frankincense.
Causes a
frankincense, very possibly the world's most widely known and used medicinal oil. And by the way, where did I first read about frankincense? Paramahansa Yogananda, Autobiography of the Yogi, which I read when I was 19, and it was so tough to read that I couldn't read it. I thought, I know I should be reading this, but I just didn't have the mind power. I thought, I can't read this. I knew it was good, too. I couldn't read it. So I put it down. So about 15 years later, I picked it up, and I read it. And then during the pandemic, I happened to be wandering into a thrift store one day, and had a copy of Autobiography of the Yogi. So I figured that's a good time to buy it. I'm not doing anything. So I read it again. And once again, as an old man, I read it. I thought, it was still hard to read. I thought, it's just hard to read because I guess I'm not really spiritual. I just can't seem to read the spiritual stuff. I read it, but I just can't seem to grab it. But he, Paramahansa Yogananda, talks about frankincense in that book that was published in 1949 and talks about nutrition. And see, that I can understand. That I get. So once again, and frankincense, in the ancient world, they use frankincense. Let's go back to spiritual stuff. In the ancient world, in the churches, they use frankincense. They said it gathered the prayers and brought them to heaven. And also, it disinfects large public spaces. So the ancients, our ancestors, were not so silly. But through empirical evidence, they knew what worked for them. And frankincense helps heal skin cancer. Let me repeat that. Frankincense helps heal skin cancer. Where can you get that reference? You go on PubMed, U.S. government website, where they have a study, University of Kansas, where frankincense helps heal skin cancer. And frankincense and myrrh, which, by the way, equally good as frankincense, but not quite as well known as frankincense, both are great for the skin. And as beauty treatments, frankincense and myrrh are fantastic. And to heal scars and burns and wounds, frankincense and myrrh are fantastic. So let me say this. Let's talk about skin again, my favorite subject. I had some acne scars that I had for 50 years, and I mean that literally. And they always were just there. And I thought, well, they're there. And, you know, I'm not happy, but I got them. So I figured I'll put frankincense and myrrh on them. What happens? Well, and I don't do it every day because I don't do everything every day. So those scars have gone down by about 90%. And they were like lumps. And they were there for 50 years. And the frankincense and myrrh, I applied them topically directly. Now, some people say, oh, no, you should use a carrier oil. Now, on the carrier oil thing, like olive oil, coconut oil, okay, fine, avocado oil, on your face, you might choose to use carrier oil. I'm not saying no. But on your knees, something like that, your elbow, I don't think you need to. But if you want to, no problem. But I use them, no carrier oil, put them right on. And I was so impressed. And also, I thought to myself, oh, Joshua, you keep learning new stuff. Now, don't laugh at that. Because, you know, when I was 30, I thought, oh, when I get to be older, maybe I'll stagnate. Because I saw my parents, and I thought, I could have been wrong about this. I thought maybe they weren't going anywhere with their ideas. I wasn't sure. I shouldn't want to be unkind. But I see that I'm learning all the time. For example, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I have an Acme juicer. I got two of them, which I've had from the 70s. And I make carrot parsley juice. I make juice, right? And it never dawned on me or any other member of my generation to add ginger or turmeric. But people of, say, my children's generation, some intelligent people decided, hey, we're going to start using turmeric and ginger, and we're going to juice it. Now, my group, Kulvinskas, people I hung out with, you know, they were heavyweights. Kulvinskas was the heavyweight. No discussion of ginger or Frank. But new people with new information, and now every one of us in this room, we use ginger, we use turmeric, we don't even think about it. But in the 60s and 70s, you and I didn't. In the 80s, no. New information, it was great. I picked up on it, and I use it now. So I'm incorporating all this new stuff, and I'm so happy about that. And again, frankincense and myrrh, and if you don't want to spend the money, you can use lavender oil, which actually seems to be maybe almost as good. It's a third the price. I want to mention that. Anyway, but frankincense and myrrh, I like to recommend those.
There are multiple studies on PubMed that show that frankincense causes apoptosis.
Okay.
So, and I met a man several years ago. I've been involved with essential oils for about 20 years, 15, 20 years. And I met a man about 4 years after I got involved, and he had had colon cancer that had metastasized to his liver. And the first time he had the cancer, he got surgery, chemo, radiation, all that. That when it came back, he just told them to take the tumor out of his liver, and then he just started taking frankincense. He was taking 3 drops 3 times a day under his tongue, and he had been in remission for 4 years when I met him.
Right.
So it's pretty amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, there are many, quote, cures for cancer. It's not just, got to do this X. It's only one thing to do, and that's it for cancer. No, no, no. As it turns out, there are many legitimate ways to heal something as serious as cancer. And that is just fantastic for us to know. You know, so it's not like, no, you got to do this and this is it. It's the only thing to do. Anything else is bogus. No, no. You have lots of different choices that are successful to heal cancer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Remember, do you remember Charlotte Gerson Strauss? Charlotte Gerson Strauss? Yeah,
I remember the name.
Yeah, the Strauss, the Gerson therapy for cancer. It was Max Gerson, German MD, Jewish, had to flee the Nazis because they were killing everybody. So he came to America, and he... In the late 40s, he published, I think it was what? Was it 50 cases of cancer or something? And he was an MD, German MD. And so he was writing about, it was nature cure. He was doing what we call nature cure broadly. And he was healing patients, not with chemotherapy. No, no, no. He was using nutrition to heal patients. And he was an MD. And so that was like groundbreaking. Because if someone like me or you talks about cancer cures, people say, oh, go take a hike. Are you an MD? Just go take a hike. We're not even going to talk to you. You're just a terrible person. But he was an MD, so his book was very influential. And I'm proud to say, I never saw him lecture, but Charlotte Gerson Strauss's daughter, I mentioned as we were chatting, when she was 94 years old, I saw her lecture at the Cancer Control Society meeting in the Ambassador Hotel it wasn't the Ambassador, I apologize for that. It was at the hotel in L.A. here, and she was 94, and she's tall and straight, and skinny, and she would lecture without a microphone. She was hilarious. She was just fantastic. I just loved her. And her son, he was a graduate of Annapolis. He was in the military. And so they had the clinic in Mexico, and they kept it rolling for a long time. She passed away. Her son said she would have died because for some reason she was older and a little bit frail, and the doctors got a hold of her. And the son went down there and took away from the doctors, and he kept her alive for a couple more years. But the doctors were busy pumping her full of drugs. But Charlotte Gerson Strauss was great. So I had the good fortune to hear some great wellness people of my parents' generation who lectured in person. I saw John Christopher, the Mormon herbalist. I mentioned that because John Christopher made cayenne pepper popular again. John Christopher. John, he was great. And in 1977, I saw him lecture in Florida at the Hallandale Nutrition Workshop. I was living in Hallandale, Florida at the time. And he was fantastic. And he was Mormon. I mention that because the Mormons were very involved with nutrition. And they had a lot of herbal companies. But because there's so much hatred directed towards Mormons, they didn't want anybody to know, and so they kept it quiet. I'm just mentioning that because, again, we're talking about nutrition and spiritual stuff and all the confluence of all the different eddies of history that we're all involved with in our daily life. Well, let me tell you one story, and that'll be end in stories. How about this? So we all remember, Celestial Seasonings, the tea company. Remember Celestial Seasonings? Okay. And at one time in the 70s, they were the best tea company. Then they sold to, you know, who bought them? Hain or Nestle? Now they have no value. And why do I criticize them so strongly? Because now they've got artificial flavors and colors in them, and frankly, they're mediocre. Okay, but at one time, they were the best. So the guy who started it, whose name was Mo Siegel, and he, and it shows how old the story is, he, in the back of his Datsun station wagon, it wasn't even a Nissan, it was a Datsun station wagon, before they renamed him Nissan, he would sell herbs out of the back, and he would sell herbs. And then he started Celestial Seasonings. And they, who started Celestial Seasonings, they were all in Boulder, Colorado. Now, who else was in Boulder, Colorado? Well, Guru Maharaji. Maharaji was a, those who were my age remember, when the 13-year-old spiritual master came from India, it was Guru Maharaji, and he attracted a lot of people, and he used to, you know, he was very popular. He would talk about spiritual stuff. And so almost all the people who were involved with Celestial Seasonings, they were all premies. They all followed Guru Maharaji, but they didn't want anyone to know because everyone hated them for that. You know, there was a lot of, our parents' generation, you know, they were real concerned. I'm Jewish. The parents were very concerned if you weren't Jewish or Christian. They thought, oh my God, what are you studying? Buddhism, Hinduism? What's wrong with you? That's just terrible. No, really. And it was like, now we kind of smile. But at the time, and my generation thought, well, we're just reading this. You know, I mean, Thoreau read this. Bronson Alcott, Charles Lane, the Transcendentalists, they all were reading the Bhagavad Gita in the 19th century. Just Bhagavad Gita. It's literature. Bhagavad Gita. No, that didn't fly. Parents were afraid that we were doing a terrible thing. It was terrible. And so there was a lot of pressure. Now, that's all kind of faded. I mention that once again because how everything kind of flows together, how everybody influences everybody else, and for the good, for the good. Sir, you have a question?
Yeah, I'll try to make the short of the long of it. I have a television show myself, actually. So I've interviewed rock and roll people and Academy Award winning people.
What rock and rolls have you interviewed?
Well, people that have worked with Stevie Wonder that have won Grammys and, you know.
Okay.
I've interviewed presidential candidates, Indian organic farmers, which is where I got this hat. And Paul McCartney, I've met him. I was a media ambassador for a UN program. So I'm a peace activist also. And Natural Health First is the name of the activist group I co-founded during this era of time. My question is, with all the misinformation that's out there, do you know of a single website or maybe multiple websites that would be actually good go-to sources to get information about nutrition and natural health and things like that? Because there's so many distractions, and when you look at ingredients, you know, there's so many oils in these, in all of our foods, and everything is about making a profit instead of just making good, nutritious foods.
Well,
so
you can do both, but we all need money. We need money. I don't pretend not to. We all need money. Okay, so let me say this.
But there's a difference between profits and just and needing money.
Yes.
But anyway.
Yes. Okay. All right. Okay. So, I like the same websites that we all like. I like Joseph McCullough. He's pretty good. I like McCullough. Now he makes the occasional flub, but don't we all? But McCullough's good. And then Kennedy changed the game with his website. Why?
Right.
Because he's got all these. I keep saying this. These talented women around him who are all PhDs and attorneys, and these women are powerhouses. So he's got a team around him, so his website is the best. And McCullough, because he has those people around him, is not quite as good, but those are two I like. And, oh my goodness, and there are many others I actually always read. Oh, you know who I also like? The young guy, Josh Axe. I like Josh Axe. He's good. I like Josh Axe. There are a lot of young ones around who I like. There are dozens that I read, and a lot of them I like very much. My concern, but of course this is just my thing, is if they start throwing in too much political stuff, what happens is you right away lose half your audience because the country's pretty divided, as it's always been, and so half the people think, oh, you like X? We hate you because you like him and we like the other guy. And so like I try not to do any of that because I'm just a wellness guy, and I want to talk about wellness. Now, if someone supports wellness ideas, then I'm happy to talk to them. But again, McCullough's I like McCullough and Kennedy, and those are my, and then, you know, also the regenerative agriculture movement, the regenerative people, who, by the way, about, was it 7 or 8, 9 years ago, they kind of came out of the blue to me, because I didn't know about them. I was doing organic when that was great, Robert Rodale, et cetera, they were great. But then the regeneratives came around, and I thought, aha, fantastic. I wasn't the first guy on the scene with that one, but I thought, okay, I recognized it was good, so I started paying attention. And I like them. Some of the vegan activists are annoyed with them because they use animal manures to improve the quality of the soil. And I think that's a good thing, and I think it's always been that way. And the people who say, no, 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 we want to farm organically and we don't want to use any animal manures, I think ultimately their soils are lacking. Now, my vegan colleagues, they get annoyed at me for that one. But I think that the science is, or the information is on the side of the regenerative agriculture people, who I'm very proud of, because I think they've added to the literature and they've added to our understanding of wellness, and they are great. And they, my group didn't do that. My generation, which I'm very proud of, you know, very proud of what we did. But man, there's all sorts of new guys bringing all sorts of new stuff, just the way my father, mother generation, they brought all sorts of stuff, and that my grandparents and great-grandparents, and every generation kind of like adds new stuff in wellness, which is the only area that I know.
And permaculture is also much more than just gardening,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
so
right,
that's an important term as well. Yeah. Thank you.
What's the name of your, give us a plug. What's your name of your show?
The name of the show is The Now Man Show. It broadcasts on the Arroyo Channel here out of Pasadena, but you can also see it on YouTube as The Now Man Show on the Arroyo Channel, A-R-R-O-Y-O.
And your name?
I'm Dan Nicewander.
Dan, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. And thanks for talking about rock and roll. I like talking about
rock
everything.
And roll. It's everything. It's arts, entertainment, education, and news, and politics. I've even had a question to Kennedy once myself, so.
Oh, yeah, Kennedy.
And Andrew Yang, Jill Stein.
Yeah, Kennedy.
When I had
Kennedy,
Farrell, Ed Asner, a lot of people.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ed Asner's good. Although he was a nutrition guy.
He
was a. I liked Ed Asner. I saw him once at a meeting, and he unfortunately was busy drinking. And I thought, Ed, you're getting awful heavy. You know, when you're 80 years old, you know, you can't carry it. It's one thing to be 20, you'll be Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. Yeah, but when you're 80, I thought, Ed, you got to cut out drinking all that wine you think is so sophisticated. I didn't say anything to him because I didn't know him. But I thought, no, Ed, you're pissing it away here, Ed. You're pissing it away, not to be crude, but like, you know, we only have this body, and man, you better take care of it. And again, when you're 20, you can't possibly know that. But when you get older and you have injury, you realize, oh, my God, this is upsetting. I don't want any more of this. Okay.
Yes. Just a quick question. And I was initially going to ask you to talk about Ann Wigmore because she was one of my favorites. And living in, growing up in outside of Boston, I'm sorry I never knew about her back then. That would have been very wonderful. But have you thought of, or have you written a book? I like the fact that you bring up and you have knowledge of Mr. Christopher and Bernard, you know, who were very foundational.
They were. Four generations,
And Dr. Schultz, Botanical Pharmacy, studied with some of these people, so he's very basic, hardcore. But
good, he's good.
He doesn't get into a lot of fads. A lot of people in our current time have lost these names, and Aunt, you know, Bernard Jensen and Christopher and others. So I was just wondering if you've thought of writing a book, because you do have all these interactions and fun stories and yet interesting stories, and especially like with down in Escondido, I love that.
Yeah, I saw, in 1986, by the way,
yeah,
he announced, I had my store in Hallandale at the time, Hallandale, Florida, and my store was 1,200 square feet, which was, at the time, good size for a store. Now it's laughable. You know, now the store's Sprouts and Whole Foods, 35,000 square feet, but my store was good size for the time, and the name of the shop was Here's to Your Health, which I thought was a good name. Stores in my era, you might remember this, from my era, stores were named Harvest Natural, Peanut Butter Conspiracy, you know, that was the name of stores. And my generation, these are great names. But mine was a little straighter. Mine was just called Here's to Your Health, which I thought was a good name. But so now the shops are big because now we're people are paying more attention to us. That's all. Anyway, but yeah. By the way, let me say this. I'm very proud to say this. When I was a teenage boy, I took a semester off from college. This was actually 1970, and I went to work for R.J. Cheatham. You think I made that name up? His name was R.J. Cheatham, and he ran the Shangri-La Hygienic Institute in Bonita Springs, Florida, which was a raw foods place, vegan, that used the ideas of Herbert Shelton. And I taught yoga there, and I worked in the garden. And he liked me, Cheatham, and he was a cancer patient. He was a skinny guy. When he would take his shirt off, he had this huge scar where the MDs cut a big hole in him, and he decided after that was done, no more of that. And he hit upon natural hygiene, saved his life, and he had this place that was very successful. And again, there were very few of them in those days. So, it was cool. And he was a nice guy. And we ate a lot of fruit, which I even knew at the time wasn't nourishing. I mean, it was good, but it wasn't enough. I knew it was good, but it wasn't enough. So that's the thing, because I had friends who were fruitarian, and they aspired to be breatharians, which I thought, that's apocryphal, but okay. But I knew when I ate fruit, which I loved, that it was good, but it wasn't enough. My blood sugar was all over the map,
So. Good cleansing as well.
Good cleansing, yeah. Right, good cleansing.
But some of the individuals that you mentioned.
Well, anyway, so let me mention this. So through R.J. Cheatham, I wrote an article about Sylvester Graham, which was published in, get this, Dr. Shelton's Hygienic Review. So I'm published. And also I was published in East West Journal, which was published in Boston. I did a review of Victor Kovinskis' early book called Love Your Body.
Okay.
And I was also, used to be a magazine called In Flight. I was published in that. So that's it for me in publishing. But thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
I think my 4 hours is up. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, Joshua Lane, thank you very much for coming.
It was fun.
And, let us know one more time, real quick, how we can find you on the radio.
Okay, so the easiest thing is go to my website, Here's to Your Health with Joshua Lane. You can go to the individual stations, but it's easy to go to my website. All the shows are archived. And all the people that you already know who their names are, you've read their book. Earl Mundell wrote Vitamin Bible. Earl was on my show all the time.
Okay.
Earl's in his 80s. He wrote the Vitamin Bible. It sold 12 million copies. Now, people say, oh, that's a lie. No, he sold 12 million copies. It's one of the most amazing successes in all of publishing. And it's been published, I think, in 34 languages. And when it came out in 79, the Vitamin Bible, when I read it, I was a young man. I thought, my God, this is not crap. This is actually, because most of the mainstream books, they were just awful, watered down, nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nothing. They were just awful. I hated them. His book was like, whoa. It was great, and it sold 12 million copies. I like Earl Mundell. He's great.
Nice.
Oh, and by the way, when he became very famous, he used to hang out with various famous celebrities. He hung out with Shecky Green. Who knows who Shecky Green is? Shecky Green. He hung out with Shecky. Yeah. He used to be hilarious, Shecky Green. In Las Vegas, he hung out in a steam room with Shecky Green and a couple of other comedians. But Shecky Green, I'm a big Shecky Green fan. Anyway, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, Joshua, if you want to, I'm sure others will have questions. But thank you for coming. Okay, we can...